I'd like to welcome you to Midday's December 4th meeting. Thank you for coming out on the dark night. But I understand, after the 21st, the sun starts going down later, so the trend is wrong. So I'd like to call the meeting to order. First item is any changes to the agenda? Next item is approval of the June 22nd, 23 minutes. Has everyone had a chance to review them? Any questions? I had a motion to approve the June 22nd minutes.
Sure.
Any further discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Next item is the approval of fiscal year 23 audit reports. That's tentative. The auditors have not delivered any material for review. So, that's out. And David? Mark, did you come in here to speak?
Sure. First of all, happy holidays, everybody. I think last time we'll see each other before the year ends. So thanks for coming out and welcome. I'd like to introduce Kevin Chu from the Vermont Futures Project. I've seen Kevin give a presentation on what he's going to speak to tonight a couple of different times. It's very interesting and kind of eye-opening in many respects. But I thought it would be good for our board to hear what we're talking about as far as the needed population growth and needed increases in housing and demographics. So with that, I'll let Kevin talk about the board.
Thank you, Dave. Should I stand up there?
Yeah.
I'll come around.
Let's see you run it, Kevin.
There are slides on your at each place.
Good evening, everyone. Thanks for having me. I'm really happy to come back to Newport, one of my favorite parts of the state. My name is Kevin Chu. I'm the executive director of the Vermont Futures Project. The Futures Project is a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization with a Vermont Chamber of Commerce Foundation organization. And the Futures Project was launched back in about 2015, before my time. So I won't take any credit for anything that came before 2022. The Futures Project pursues a mission question, which is that first page on the sheet in front of you. So the work that we do is to answer this question: how can we use data to support the evolution of Vermont's economy for the providing future full opportunity for all? Now, the way we're trying to answer this question now is by working on developing an economic action plan at the state level. I'm of the mindset that I'm not smart enough to write a plan on my own, nor am I stupid enough to try, and somewhere in between. So the process, where do you start when you're not smart enough to write a plan on your own? I started by reviewing the regional set plans, comprehensive economic development strategies, to try to understand what are some of the overlapping goals and priorities that exist all around the state. And through that process, we found about 7 or 8 items that show up in multiple regions, and they all relate back to things like infrastructure, workforce, business climate, and we distilled it down into a framework that's on the second page, which is Vermont's future depends on people and places. Now, through the process, I hear in every part of the state, we need more houses. We have a housing crisis. We're having a hard time finding workers. We need more people. And as that process unfolded, I turned around and asked, well, how many houses do we need? How many people do we need? And there wasn't a firm answer. So this is an attempt at putting some numbers on paper as a starting point for a conversation. And you may be wondering, how did you arrive exactly at 802,000 that needs to be in? So I'll explain a little bit about the process, the data and research that led to creating this goal. At its core, it was a workforce gap analysis, trying to understand how many people are leaving the workforce each year versus how many people are potentially coming into the workforce. And the Vermont Department of Labor projects about 14,800 retirements per year through the end of this decade. On the supply side, we have about 5,300 total 12th grade students in the entire state of Vermont. So those two numbers don't balance each other out. We know we don't retain 100% of our high school grads either, which means there's a gap. And when we project that gap out to about 2035, the number's down to that 800,000 range. And I took the personal liberty of picking 802, because 800,000 sounds big and scary to a lot of Vermonters, but 802 for some reason seems a little bit more familiar and comfortable. I'll let you figure out why. So then from there, I worked with the Vermont Housing Finance Agency, VHFA, to develop a housing goal to match up with that population size. And correlated the two numbers using median household size. So that 350,000 is a target for non-seasonal housing units. And I think that's an important distinction to make. So the current numbers in this framework, the population is about 648,000 currently. And then in terms of non-seasonal housing units, our state's at about 270. That's the baseline we're working from. If you go to the next page, I show Vermont's age distribution of its population. Again, I mentioned that workforce gap. This is the underlying data that shows why we have a gap. You'll see that there's a peak in the 50 to 64 age groups. And I put a vertical red line there to show a traditional retirement age, and then the horizontal line says time only works in one direction. And I haven't figured out how to solve that one yet. So you may have heard the term missing middle in a lot of housing conversations. We also have a missing middle in terms of our age distribution of our population. So as folks leave the workforce, we don't have enough people to backfill those exits. And if you turn to the next page, you'll see the breakdown of our workforce. And again, it just reflects that demographic data by age. Most of the workers in the Vermont workforce are in that 45 to 64 range. Then from there, so that's sort of the economic perspective. I'm going to go from an economic perspective to an equity perspective and then an environmental perspective to show how hitting these goals is actually good across all these categories. The next page shows the racial and ethnic composition of Vermont's population. So Vermont's about 92% white compared to 59% across the U.S. And as the Census Bureau projects forward into the coming decades, they expect that the U.S. will be what they call majority-minority by about 2045, meaning that less than 50% of the U.S. population will be white. So that means future generations of the U.S. workforce will be more diverse than previous generations. And if we look at the next slide, we actually see that here in Vermont, labor force participation among many non-white categories is higher than the average, meaning that some of these trends that we're projecting nationally are starting to show up early here in Vermont. And I had a great conversation with a New York Times journalist about a month ago. The Futures Project is featured in the New York Times. And this journalist said that there's national attention on Vermont right now because we are one of the oldest states. And what other states are looking for is how are we thinking about the demographic transition? What are strategies we might try here? Because other states are going to try to learn from us. We can either be a leader for what to do or what not to do. One of those things will happen. I know which one I'd rather choose. Many of my presentations, I like to simplify the math. So let's just say 9 out of every 10 Vermonters is white. There's only two ways to change that ratio. We can do that through addition or subtraction. Subtraction doesn't help our workforce, and I don't want to be responsible for picking who gets kicked out. So addition is a way that we can increase our population, increase diversity, set ourselves up for success, just based on how the world's changing around us and who's going to be participating in the labor force. So let's move on to the next page. And I'll come at this from an environmental perspective now. So when I say housing matters most, if we take a look at the green and orange bands in this graph, those represent transportation and thermal emissions. So in terms of Vermont's greenhouse gas emissions, those are the two largest contributors. Transportation emissions shouldn't surprise us given how spread out much of Vermont is. And then the thermal emissions, the orange bucket, that's heating and cooling. 25% of the houses in Vermont were built before 1940, and they're not very thermally efficient. So we can actually make progress on our state climate goals through new construction in a very intentional and smart way that decreases the transportation needs as well. And then this may come as a surprise, but if we look at per capita greenhouse gas emissions on the next page there, this is a headline slide. Vermont is less sustainable than New Jersey. So this is data that comes from the Energy Action Network annual report looking at per capita greenhouse gas emissions. And they show that Vermont only reduced greenhouse gas emissions by about 11% over the last 15 years. And then you take a look at the states to the right of Vermont on this graph. Those are states that have made more progress on per capita emissions. They've been able to grow their economies, grow their population, build more housing. So it is possible to do all these things, to grow the economy, to build more houses, to become more sustainable, and to become more diverse. So that's behind the thinking of the population goal. Now, we'll move on to the next one. So this table here, I mentioned that the population goal is just a starting point for conversation. This is not meant to be prescriptive, but what I wanted to do is take that big state-level number, 800-2000, and just split it up so we can
pick up salads.
All I did was split up the population by current population ratios. So you can start to visualize what that gap looks like and what the annual rate of growth would need to be for the state to hit a goal with each region contributing proportionally. The table following that is the same concept using housing numbers. And then I'd like to end with a couple of data points that measure sentiment. So on this one here, results from the Vermonter poll. The Vermont Futures Project sponsored this question in the 2022 Vermonter poll, asking, are you supportive of growing Vermont's population size to strengthen its workforce? Now, I found a few things interesting. There are more Vermonters that say yes than no. And then I went into looking at the results with my own bias. I thought that younger Vermonters would say yes at higher rates than older Vermonters, but I was wrong. And it's okay to look at data and find out we're wrong sometimes and admit it too. So it was the exact opposite. The youngest respondents said no at higher rates, and the older the respondents got, the more likely they were to say yes. So in trying to understand why this might be the case, I think there's an underlying scarcity mindset that younger respondents bring into how they answer this when they hear population growth and they're already paying high rent, having trouble finding a starter home, they may see population growth as competition. And then with older respondents, they're more likely to own a home, they'll be insulated from some of the housing market dynamics. They may be business owners or leaders that are looking for that next generation and thinking about succession planning, and they may be trying to hire people and having trouble finding employees. So there's sort of a wisdom that comes with age that's reflected in the data here. And then the final slide, Professor Packett. I mentioned that scarcity mindset. So this is a poll that was conducted by Vermont Public. And this was just last year. they asked, what advice would you give to an 18-year-old that's thinking about building a successful life and career? And the narrative that we've been telling in Berkeley, telling our young people in Vermont is, you have to go elsewhere. You have to leave. 42% of respondents said, leave Vermont. Right, so we know we already have dwindling homegrown talent supply, only 5,312 graders in the whole state last year. We're telling them they have to go somewhere else. So the ones that stay are scared that there are limited opportunities for them, which is why they might perceive population growth as a threat. It's time for us to help tell a new narrative. When we look at the underlying numbers, a decade ago, this story made sense. A decade ago, there were 2 job seekers for every 1 open job in Vermont. Right? More people looking for work than work available. Today, there are about 3 open jobs for every 1 job seeker. So even if every person who's currently looking for work in Vermont found a Vermont-based job, we'd still have over 12,000 open jobs in the state. But this is still the narrative that we're telling people, so it hasn't caught up to where the data is. And that's where I'm actually going to ask all of you to help change that narrative, share this data, talk to folks in your circle, and if you want to connect anyone with me as well who wants to dive into any of this, my contact information is on the front page. Like I said, this launching of the goals, the population and housing goals, is a starting point for conversation. I've been presenting to groups all around the state. Part of the process is also to collect input and feedback. I want to hear from Vermonters about how we get there collectively so that each part of the state can pitch in and also benefit from that population growth and housing growth. I'll end it there and open it up to questions or discussion.
Do you get a lot of questions about this particular figure?
I get questions all the time, which is great because I'm
just the one about sustainability.
Yes.
Relative to other states.
Yes. What question do you have for that?
Well, you know, the Southern Appalachian State, we've got open land and we've got a certain population density, which needs to be figured in here. And in New Jersey, it's got 40 times the average population of the United States.
Yes.
You know, the average parcel of
the United States. You have 20 minutes
left.
Yeah, so it will, yeah,
New
work.
Jersey's population density is about 1,200 people per square mile.
Because I went to Texas and went to South and a break. And we've had that.
Vermont has about 70 people per square mile.
Okay, that's
fine.
Is that going to
be us? And if we grow the population to 2,000, we'll go from 70 to about 80.
These
why I say and then this goal is developed to try to balance the environment, the economy, inequity. The goal is just to grow the economy. We're trying to sort of fill in that missing middle in terms of the population distribution to take care of Vermont's
statement. Oh, it's pretty false.
The measure is per capita greenhouse gas emissions. New Jersey's ahead of Vermont.
How do you figure that? I mean, New Jersey, with the population it's got, has got way more greenhouse gas emissions than
New Jersey. They live a lot closer to their work.
Total, but that's a measure per capita.
True, yeah.
Not the population.
Okay, per capita, you're saying? Yes, those figures are
travel further.
That's right. So, it's a per capita measure, not an absolute measure.
That measure is misleading.
So that's how the numbers were presented by the Energy Action Network.
And this is the reduction from the name of the period of time. It looks to me like the bottom line number here is showing the reductions made over a span of time.
Yeah, well, that's
New Jersey has made more progress reducing their emissions per capita than we
have. There's got a lot more to do.
The statement is about sustainability in absolute terms. Walk away and turn a key and see which one fails for
it. As far as CO2 reduction, what about Mars
sequestering services. I don't understand how cramming 100,000 more people in here is not going to threaten the forest, which sequesters are.
And that's why we're having a conversation about now, because if it's 150,000 people and we just sort of haphazardly put them all over Vermont in a way that fragments forests and ecosystems and wetlands, then it is a major detriment to the environment. And that's why we're trying to get into Vermont, how we get there, because we're creating smart growth and communities that promote density, lower transportation emissions, and there's a path forward that also preserves and protects the natural resources of Vermont.
You're talking about increasing the population by a third. Yeah. That's extreme. Man.
See some hands over there?
Thank you. I don't have any thought one way or the other about increasing the population. I won't be doing any of that. So. But I do question the way that the greenhouse gas emissions are calculated. You know, generally what those analyses do is they figure out what kind of fossil fuels are being burnt in the state. And I think that that's a flawed measure of greenhouse gas responsibility. A better measure would be what are the emissions associated with all of the goods and services that we consume. And because when we talk about what we actually burn here, and we try to put any limits on it, and we try to we try to lower those emissions with financial burdens, we're hurting businesses in Vermont that are producing goods or could produce goods that are consumed someplace else, and those places that we export those goods to, they should be responsible for the emissions produced by the goods that we create here.
So this figure does show a distribution of greenhouse gas emissions across different sectors in Vermont. I pointed out the green and the orange, thermal and transportation, but you can also see the contributions from agriculture, production of electricity, industrial processes, and waste management as part of that overall portfolio.
But it doesn't get reflected in your per capita number.
The per capita number? Yeah. So that number takes a look at the total greenhouse gas emissions
right.
And then divides it.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, if you took a... If you used a consumer, took a consumer approach to greenhouse gas responsibilities, the numbers would be very different.
Yeah.
And, you know, I would argue that that's what we should be doing.
20% of the residents in the town I come from eat with wood. Why? They can't afford to eat with fossil fuel. That's not going to change the median income of $46,000 per year.
Thank you. I'm looking at your back page. It says 42% of the people would choose to leave Vermont. We're facing an 18 to 25% increase in our property taxes. What do you think that 42% is going to be in 3 years? It's going to be 50% or more. And I like 70 people per square mile versus 1,200. And I think 100 would be too many in the state of Vermont. Because then we won't have a state of Vermont anymore. That's just my opinion, but I like looking at this chart. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Of those three jobs that the one person is looking for, how many are blue collar versus white collar, college education versus not much schooling besides graduate or high school?
Yeah. So the labor market in Vermont, about 70% of the jobs
do not require a four-year degree. And that there's a correlation between wages and educational requirements. That's part of why Vermont has a really difficult time retaining college graduates. So Vermont is at the very bottom of the list nationally in terms of college grad retention. We can see in the data where students go when they graduate and leave Vermont. They go to places like Boston, New York City, D.C., Denver. And if you compare the available jobs in those labor markets to Vermont, a place like Boston, about 41% of the jobs require a four-year degree or higher. So with the cost of tuition, what it is these days, families and students, when they graduate and they have loans to repay, I don't fault them for seeking a pathway elsewhere that allows them to pay off that investment. So yes, the wage challenge here in Vermont is a part of the equation, but that's, to me, another reason to focus on the economic factors and grow business and grow the wages that we can offer to Vermonters, and as a way to attract more people here, too.
And I hear you saying that we might have the labor force that we need, income earners that we need, the tax base that we need in the future, we need to attract more folks to Vermont. And I assume the reason you have people in places as a goal is that plenty of people maybe want Vermont, but they can't find a place to live in Vermont, and we can't hire folks to live. How is that?
We have to think about that.
And so I guess I'm curious, as you presented this having a goal, I assume that our build rates don't match the forecasted annual goals are, what you've heard about the biggest barriers around creating more net new units, so that we can have business for people who live in Vermont, that we need to live in Vermont.
You're right, there is a gap, and in my travels I've heard Act 250 is a popular topic. Actually, I think there's a discussion happening right now about it. Looking forward to catching up on that. But then I've heard in some parts of the state that there are local zoning regulations that communities are considering updates to, as another way to reduce barriers for development to happen. Then there's the very real challenges of interest rates, the cost of materials and labor. Those are challenges that we have a little bit less direct control over. And then I hear this like chicken or the egg conundrum about we need more houses, but we don't have the workforce to build houses. So how do we create the houses we need to attract the people? And that's where I think there are opportunities for creative solutions, such as we see in other industries with seasonal or temporary labor. We have seasonal workers in agriculture and tourism and recreation, and travel nurses. And certainly there's a premium that needs to be paid for travel nurses as an example, but could we use a similar idea when it comes to the trades to bring in extra workforce to meet surge demand to get us unstuck? That's one idea I've heard that I thought was pretty innovative.
I'll follow up on that. You've got the car, the horsepower to be tradespeople.
Yeah.
The governor gets it. You know, when plumbers, electricians are making the same as Bill Davies, I don't know if that was just undercharged makes him such a nice guy, or that's where the trend goes. But you know, if you look at the cost of college, and if you want to talk where it starts in guidance. There's nothing wrong with being a blue collar. There's nothing wrong with being a plumber, electrician. Those individuals get into the workforce making good money. I have a lot of student debt, but you go into any guidance office in the state of Vermont, and you find every college that's out there, and I bet you won't find a Tivoli, a Built by Newport, a Pool and Grain, a Pool and Lumber, a Sticks and Stuff, or any local companies that they try to push kids into. And we've done a piss poor job over the decades of thinking career centers were for kids who couldn't get a job or couldn't do anything. And if you look at what a plumber makes an hour, You know, I tell kids in junior high, when you're out of heat, it's 20 below on a Sunday. Mom and Dad aren't asking how much it's going to cost, but Mom and Dad are saying, when can you get here? Get my furnace up and running. So I think you start with, you need a workforce that can build this house. And I think you could do a good job, a better job of increasing what we have in state before you look at paying extra wages to get people from out of state to commit.
Totally agree with you on the guidance we're getting to.
Thank you.
I have to echo that because I saw back as far as 1972 when I was graduating from high school and pushed into a four-year college. I wasn't academically ready for it, and I struggled. It took me probably 15 years to land a job and to get through school. So, I mean, this elitist look at, you know, you got to go to a four-year school. And what do we have now? We have a lack of electricians, a lack of plumbers, a lack of service people. And it's because of this elitist look at putting people into jobs. It's got to be 4 years. You're going to have a four-year college. You said 70% of the jobs in Vermont are not four-year college required. So somebody coming out to go to a job like that can't afford a house, can't afford to live because the wages are so low. They're saddled with $50,000 to $100,000 in college debt of four-year college. I mean, it's unsustainable.
Yeah, I really appreciate the comments to highlight the importance of blue-collar work to our communities. I'm the son of an immigrant. My parents came from Southeast China back in 1986. Neither of them had a college degree. Neither of them spoke English when they got here. So what was available to them? Blue-collar work. And they were still able to find opportunities to integrate into a community, to give back through their work, and to raise a family. And at the time, in the 80s and 90s, that was a feasible path forward. But as the years have gone on, that pathway has become harder and harder. And that's part of what motivates me to do this work, is to make sure that opportunities continue to be available in Vermont across the socioeconomic spectrum. When we take a look at the stigma around the trades and certain type of work, that's something that holds us back. I was in a conversation with the Department of Economic Development just earlier this week, and the phrase, good job, came up in that conversation. And I paused and I just asked, what do we define as a good job? Who gets to choose? And are we sometimes do we project our own values when we talk about what a good job is? Yes, there's a consideration of the wage and salary as part of what makes a good job, but there are other factors too. We can point at things like benefits and also the social community that comes with a job that should be factored in. My mom worked as a janitor for almost 20 years. And if you just look at the salary or the wage that she earned, a lot of people would have said, oh, you're not working a good job. But she found community in that. She was able to put three kids through college because she worked at the University of Vermont, and one of her benefits was free tuition for her kids. So to our family, my mom working as a janitor was a good job. And it offends me sometimes when others project their own values and say that isn't a good job. So how do we create conditions in our communities to allow any job to be a good job? And I think we have to look at the supply side of labor and housing so that when we look at this cost of living equation, right, the wages that we can offer allow you to buy what you need to sustain a family and to put something away for retirement and to create a future that's brighter for your kids than it was for you. That's my TED talk for
today. I know there are a number of things holding back probably people who are coming to the Vermont College and who are having a problem. Obviously, that's critical to us. There are four potential home-based businesses that they have all of them. other thing is childcare, and that still is an issue in a lot of places. We're trying to find quality childcare. Those are a couple of things I have on the property, and that's the first couple times they ask. Those are issues, and I know are being addressed by the legislature and WDA and other structures, other corporations. The other thing is, I think as a benefit, is our wildlands, is our natural wildlands. I mean, we've already been considered one of the top, I'm not sure whether it's natural or cultural or combined, by National Geographic several years ago, that we're one of the top places in the world. Well, Northeast Kingdoms, particularly. And I want to see the Northeast Kingdoms become more industrial. But that's an attraction for some people. We have ski resorts up here. We have a lot of cross-country. But it's those are a couple of things that I think are holding. But again, as I heard earlier, I don't want to have a great percentage increase in my community.
Very different than Ruckman, and it's great to have different options to choices and lean into the natural resources and strengths and assets of each region. But it is a good place to start to define an answer to that question that folks in a community can get behind.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Thank you. If I can make this the last question, so Kevin can eat his meal.
I appreciate that.
Okay. Kevin, you put some big targets out there as far as population and housing, and people seem to support that to varying degrees, obviously, by the comments we've had, which is fine. But what are the next steps for the Vermont Futures Project as you finish presenting this information around the state?
Thanks for that question. Yes, people agree to it, don't agree to it. Everyone's allowed to have their opinion about the data. The reason why we wanted to get some numbers on paper to generate this type of conversation is because it helps to orient the solution-seeking conversation more productively. What I mean by that is part of my own background is in education and coaching. And I currently do some part-time coaching at middle grade college for the track and field team. When I get an athlete that comes up to me and says something like, "Coach, I want to run faster," I turn around and ask, "Okay, how much faster? Let's pick a goal that's feasible given where your abilities are now, and then create a training plan to take an incremental step to get there." But if they just broadly say, "I want to run faster," that's not a lot to work with. And I think as a state, we can do similar thing with population and housing and sort of ask, how do we plot a path forward that helps to take care of the people who are already here too, right? In terms of next steps, so as I mentioned, I'm having these conversations around the state, and the input and feedback that I'm hearing will aggregate it into a set of recommendations that will then get published in the middle of 2024, probably June. And then that information and the data will be presented back out to communities, shared with decision makers, whether it's state legislators or local select boards, anyone who wants to engage in the conversation. So this is a process of collecting, aggregating, and then redistributing.
Thank you very much.